So I've got Thomas Frank on the line with me. He's got a new book called The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule, a history and examination of the conservative agenda to re-engineer the state to side with business interests against the people. Thanks for the interview, Tom.
Well, you got it. Anytime.
Probably more than any other character in the conservative movement, you focus on Jack Abramoff as sort of the epitome of everything both corrupt and idealistic about modern right-wingers. Why is he such a uniquely fascinating character?
Well, the guy had has an amazing life story that, you know, until The Wrecking Crew came out, had really just been, touched upon very lightly in the mainstream media. And I went into it in some detail. He's a fascinating guy who, as a young man, was a great leader, a great idealist, was close to a lot of the sort of leading thinkers of the right wing. He figured out some of the sort of basic, or I guess whether he figured them out or absorbed the ideas from his right wing friends. I mean, it's impossible to tell, of course, but without asking him, he didn't want to be asked. But he figured out a lot of the strategies that we still see the right using to this day. And then, of course, he became the sort of greatest lobbyist of all time. The larger strategy that I'm thinking of is the coming together of politics and profit. The way that conservatives at some point in the 70s or 80s figured out that conservatism could be an industry, not merely a movement. It was a way that you could make money. And there's all sorts of different methods for doing this. But basically, it makes sense if you think about it. This is a movement that reveres the market and market forces and rational choice and, self-interest. What is the Ayn Rand title? Virtue of selfishness. All these sort of things. It's not, these people aren't in politics because, out of some humanitarian motive. They have their self-interest at stake too. So in the conservative movement, this is the fascinating thing, is that you can be an idealist and you can be self-interested at the same time. In fact, that's sort of the definition of the species. And Jack Abramoff exemplified this.
I was actually kind of surprised to see how much money there is in direct mail.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's still as profitable as it was once, but in the 70s and the 80s, it was a huge deal. And there's a whole bunch of these guys down in Northern Virginia. This whole industry, by the way, is based in the suburbs of Washington that are in Virginia. You figure out a cause, let's say the Panama Canal Treaty, right, which I think Jimmy Carter signed, and you send out millions of letters telling, what you and I would call junk mail, millions of letters to people around the country telling them that if they don't give, to your organization, the U.S. is going to give away the Panama Canal, and somehow the Soviets are going to get control of it, and it's going to be the end of us all. And people respond, and there are two characteristics that are worth pointing out. One is that direct mail was incredibly shrill and overstated its point. And well, I mean, that's look. It's crazy stuff. If you go back and read it, it's crazy politics, and it was deliberately so. There's people that were experts at writing it. The other thing to remember about it, in that sense, is that it pushed our politics way to the right. With these gigantic mass mailings it would be like the political equivalent of, one of those supermarket tabloids where they're, forever discovering things on Mars or something like that. It was that kind of politics. The other thing is that it's immensely profitable for the guy who does the mailing, not necessarily for the organization that sponsors it. You get something in the mail from, the College Republicans or the Conservative Caucus or something like that. That group might do very well from the mailing, but the person who will definitely do very well is the guy that has the mailing list and that put the thing together and that sends it out.
So you describe the corruption of D.C. under conservative rule as sort of a form of idealism. Can you elaborate on how corruption can be idealistic?
Yeah, it's a funny thing, but I mean, think about it. If you're a true believer in the free market, in laissez-faire, then you know, all these sort of the things that you and I think of as being you know, the civic ideals get stood on their heads. The state, the government, is not a site for idealism. The state is a perversion. It's something that has to be done away with, has to be wrecked, has to be cut down to size. All, you know, all these things that conservatives say all the time. And business, on the other hand, becomes a site of intense, you know, of reverence, almost worship. And so you find conservative theorists doing things like, I have a whole chapter filled with this stuff, conservative theorists saying things like, you know, there's nothing wrong with insider trading back in the 80s. Yes. And these are, by the way, these are the same conservative theorists that write books and articles about corruption in Washington, D.C., denouncing it. Nothing wrong with insider trading. Nothing wrong with price fixing between, you know, companies. I found a guy, an economist, who said there's nothing wrong with kickbacks, you know, in certain situations. You know, another guy who said, and the one that really shocked me was a guy who said that in certain situations there's nothing wrong with bribery. Bribery is the market acting in self-defense against, you know, the sort of depredations of the state. You know, the state is, if the state is evil and the market is pure and good and light, then, you know, everything is stood on its head. And so it's possible to be extremely idealistic and to do these terrible things. And in fact, that is the people that I'm describing. I mean, you, a guy like Grover Norquist, you know, the K Street Project, do you know what this is?
Yeah.
Do you think should I tell your readers what it is?
Yes, yeah.
Well, the K Street Project, it was a scheme to force the lobbying industry, using the power of the state to force the lobbying industry to become more Republican, to become more closely aligned with the Republican Party. And this has got a lot of attention in the last 10 years. You know, there's been a lot of different people pushing it. Tom DeLay was pushing it. Rick Santorum was pushing it. A lot of people. And it was Grover Norquist is sort of the one who invented the idea. And it's an ingenious idea. It's, I mean, let's hand it to him. It's a brilliant idea. But when people hear about it, they think, my God, that's so evil. You know, that's people's reaction, right? It's perfectly legal, but you know, but you got to remember, these are guys like Rick Santorum is by his own lights highly idealistic. Grover Norquist is intensely idealistic. You know, he's a guy who really, really believes. So yeah, it's these things coincide all the time.
Another thing that the book is so timely, because I think only in the past couple of years is the mainstream media and the public becoming aware of the strategy to dismantle the liberal state through strategic political appointments.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on how this works and give some examples of some glaringly bad political appointments?
Sure. They're all too obvious now. But the idea is you can't, if you know, let's say you're a conservative, you don't like certain aspects of the state. You don't like the Environmental Protection Agency. You don't like the Labor Department. There's all sorts of things about the government that you don't like, but you can't do away with them because the public expects these organizations to exist. The public expects that there's someone looking out for them at work. There's someone making sure that their water is fit to drink. You know, all these things that you and I, you know, expect in a modern society. So they can't just do away with these things. So what they do instead is they strategically dismantle them. You know, they get rid of a lot of employees. They make sure that the people running the organizations don't believe in the missions. The worst has been at the Department of Labor, which has just been packed with sort of anti-labor, anti-organized labor advocates and that sort of thing, people that really don't believe in the mission. And, I mean, it's not a surprise. They always seem to be, you know, asleep at the switch when somebody comes up with some incredible workplace, you know, some unbelievable story of workplace, you know, what would you say, like child labor or something like that. There was that story that came out of Iowa a few weeks ago, child labor at a meatpacking plant, of all things. You know, where's the Department of Labor Did you hear about that story?
No, I didn't hear about that.
It's just shocking, you know? It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was the Iowa Department of Labor that's prosecuting it, apparently. I might be behind the times, of course. I haven't read a newspaper. I'm on a book tour. I haven't read a newspaper in about 2 weeks, so.
So where would you put the whole disaster with Hurricane Katrina and FEMA in this constellation of political appointments?
Well, the FEMA was an agency that worked very well in its past. And what happens is that when conservatives take control of the state, something like FEMA they regard as a patronage parking lot, you know, and so they filled it up with guys that needed a little domain to run and to profit from. And let's see, the head of FEMA was Bush's, the first one under Bush was his campaign manager, a guy that had no disaster experience or very little. I don't think he had any. And he quit after a few years and became a consultant, otherwise known as a lobbyist, to companies that, you know, companies that get big FEMA contracts. You know, big surprise there. And he was succeeded by Michael Brown, who had no experience in disasters or preparedness or anything. And of course, that's who was at the wheel when the hurricane hit New Orleans. And at the same time, the whole agency was hollowed out. I mean, not deliberately. I don't think Bush wanted to have such a public relations disaster as what happened after Katrina. But it's inevitable when you treat government with contempt, you know, and when you treat government employees with contempt, which is certainly what they do. You know, they're forever denouncing them and calling them names. And farming out their work to private companies where the people get paid much, much, much more. And there's a term that kept coming up when I would talk to people. It was FEMA-tized. They'd say this or that agency has been FEMA-tized, which is to say it's been wrecked. It's been wrecked. FEMA is the most glaring example, but there's lots more.
I work in the field of reproductive rights, and it's been kind of interesting dealing with the political appointments in the past eight years. And I'm kind of curious how you feel about that, because it's not so much, I think, that the appointments in places like Health and Human Services oppose the agency's mission as much as they oppose women's right to reproductive health care. What's your take on that?
This is a field I do not know about. I probably should have researched it. I mean, there's so many examples out there. So they just oppose part of the mission, is what you're saying?
Well, I don't know, but one thing that they do is they use the regulatory power of things like Health and Human Services to put obstacles, so more state interference with people's lives, not less, and commerce. So things like the Health and Human Services trying to redefine contraception as abortion so that healthcare providers can refuse to sell it to you.
Oh, did they really do that?
Yes.
That's outrageous. That's a good example of another sort of aspect of the conservative state, which is this pure opportunism. This is more, I would say, the conservative movement. They say they're against, you know, we all know the mantra, they're against big government, therefore the individual, blah, 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 blah. Well, they aren't really. I mean, what they're for is they're for, laissez-faire, for business. Everything else follows from that. So they need to appease a certain constituency by doing something like this. They do it. Individual rights are just, that's way down the list of things that they care about. You know, the main things are, as you find when you study these people, the main things are always the business community, the very wealthy, the free market, that sort of thing. And keeping their coalition together.
So not to change the subject, but a little bit to go back to the kind of history of things, because I think my readers will be fascinated with this. You have a pretty extensive history of the American conservative movement's involvement with defending the apartheid government of South Africa.
Yes, I do.
So why did you go into so much detail on this issue?
I got fascinated by it. And come on, you've got to admit, it's an incredible story, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
And you get lost in the story, and I had to sort of stop myself at some point. I was like, what am I doing? And by the way, you should know, it's a it's one of the most unpleasant things to research that I've, you know, one of the most unpleasant bits of research that I've ever done. I mean, apartheid South Africa, there's just, you know, I was around at the time, and I marched in the protests and that sort of thing, but I didn't really know anything about, you know, apartheid except for that it was wrong. And now I know a lot more. It was really bad news. But the reason I went into it let's look at it from the broadest perspective. It's because it's a perfect illustration of conservatism's mutability, of its opportunism, that they will, you know, I started in the 70s when the conservative movement is, you know, they love South Africa. It's not that they're racist or that they believe in apartheid, but they loved South Africa for, you know, a lot of different reasons. They thought it was a country just like us, blah, blah, blah. And by the end of the period, they had completely turned on on apartheid and were telling, you know, we're instead arguing that what South Africa had, you know, that apartheid was a kind of socialist project, and that you had to overturn, you know, that they were there, now they were on the side of the people opposing apartheid, and the reason they were opposing it was because apartheid was a violation of the free market. And so they dumped all sorts of their friends along the way, but it's always there, you know, what it looks like on the surface is that they changed really dramatically. But in fact, they didn't. They always stay true to, you know, one or two basic principles: the business community, the free market, and everything else can go to hell. So that's why I did it. And there's some very, I mean, poignant illustrations of this along the way. The heart of it is, I was following the career of Jack Abramoff, and at some point he became the head of a foundation, a think tank, I should say, based in Washington, that turned out years later to be a project of South African military intelligence. Okay? So Jack Abramoff, super lobbyist, super corruptionist in his youth, was essentially, whether witting or unwitting, an agent of South African military intelligence. It's a shocking thing to figure out. And so I started, I read through all this, all his think tanks, you know, publications, all their magazines and their newsletters and all this sort of thing. And they started out being these kind of extreme red baiters, you know, calling everyone a communist, you know, which is what Abramoff did in his early years. That was sort of how he went about things, was calling everybody a commie. And this fit well with the sort of apartheid agenda. You know, in South Africa, they called everyone was a commie. If they weren't on board with the regime. And then the Soviet Union fell, right? So how are you going to defend apartheid now? How are you going to defend the regime in South Africa when the communist threat has just evaporated overnight? What are you going to do? Well, they became libertarians. It's this very, very peculiar shift. Overnight, well, it wasn't overnight, it was sort of gradual, but when the Soviet Union fell apart, it became a libertarian think tank. And they started giving out, like, Hayek awards and all this sort of thing, and worshiping Friedrich Hayek and all this. And the idea then being that, you know, South Africa, now they were opposed to the apartheid regime, and the regime had to, you know, do away with, say, electricity regulation in South Africa. They would call something like electricity regulation Stalinist, you know, and the state had to get out of electricity in South Africa. You know, it's just this crazy change, but the basic principles stay the same. You serve the market, you serve the business community.
And so how does the Iraq War factor into this? I mean, South Africa was kind of an experimental state for libertarian politics, and now Iraq.
Yeah. Well, in Iraq, the Bush people really got to remake a country from the ground up using their ideals, their principles, their philosophy of government. And the way that they go about this, of course, is by turning everything over to the private sector. It's going to be a free market paradise. They're going to let the companies do everything. Government's going to stay out of it. And so they outsourced all the work. you know, took these contractors. You know, we now know it was like $100 billion has gone to private contractors in Iraq. And the result has just been catastrophe, just been, you know, disaster on a huge scale where nothing seems to get done or done right anyways. And everything is just, you know, farmed out to the, well, to the, you know, subcontractors, and they subcontracted and so on until you get down to the bottom where they've imported some workers from India or Nepal or something like that rather than hiring the people who actually live in Iraq. It's a terrible story, but this is one that the public knows well. You know, it's in the headlines all the time. It also was shocking to me when I did the research and read up on just what a disaster Iraq reconstruction has been. I mean, this was privatized government, you know, at its worst. They gave they just turned over the reins to private companies. And by the way, this is not because, you know, how they're always saying, I don't know if you're aware of this, conservatives now are very embarrassed of the Bush administration because it's so unpopular. You know, he's the least pop. He has the lowest approval rating of any president ever. And so conservatives want to be done with this guy and you know, put some daylight between him and their movement. And so they're always saying, well, he isn't really a conservative. You know, Bush isn't really a conservative. You know, this is the man they worshipped 4 years ago. But, okay, in Iraq, what he did was perfectly in keeping with conservative political theory, or with, I should say, free market political theory. I mean, right down the line, he did exactly what he was supposed to do. It was this great, you know, burst of idealism. Turn it all over to the market. Let the market do it. And the market just screwed that country over.
Do you have any kind of ideas on what liberals can do to kind of fight back against the lobbyists, the corporatists, the whole defunding the left strategy?
Well, I'm, you know, admittedly the book ends on kind of a pessimistic note because conservatives have played the strategic game much better than liberals have. You know, they've developed, you know, plans for defunding the left and for wrecking the state, doing all these things, and there is no equivalent on the left. Nobody has been, you know, coming up with plans for defunding the right. I don't even know how you would do that. You know, the right is funding incarnate, you know. And so, you know, you look at the way Washington works now, and it is government by contractor. The civil service is hollowed out. You know, the contractors are the big players in Washington, D.C. Lobbying is more powerful now than it has been. Well, it's taken a bad hit since the Abramoff scandal broke, you know, and the Democrats got into Congress in 2006. But it's still, you know, an enormous industry there with an enormous amount of power. And it's going to take. So what I'm talking about is that these are not just changes in policy. These are structural changes in the state and in the way the state works. And that's going to be much harder to reverse. You know, it's going to be, in fact, extremely difficult to reverse. But I'm going to try. I'm going to be writing about my ideas for how to do it in the newspaper. Did you know I write for the Wall Street Journal?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to be writing about that in the next couple of weeks, I think.
The book is called The Wrecking Crew, and our author is Thomas Frank. Thanks so much for joining me today, Tom.
Sure thing. My pleasure.